Marketplace is supported by Palisades Hudson Financial Group, providing comprehensive, objective advice on investments, taxes, and financial planning. More at 877-485-4000 or online at palisadeshudson.com. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There are few guarantees in life, but when you see that sign on the front door of your bank, the gold label with FDIC in bold black letters, well, the agency itself calls that a symbol of confidence for all Americans. Your deposits are guaranteed. So what to make of the news that the FDIC's Bank Rescue Fund is running low on cash? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents After the Bell, a weekly podcast that makes sense of the week in business and the economy, available at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. It is the 27th day of August. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation rescued quite a few banks over the last year or so, from IndyMac and Washington Mutual to Colonial Bank and four others just last week. The total so far this year is 81 banks, but 400 more are listed as troubled. Today, the agency announced its rescue fund dropped by 20% in the second quarter. Chairwoman Sheila Bair said, no worries, but the worries are there anyway. So for some context, we turn to Bill Isaac. He served as FDIC chief in the Reagan administration. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you.
How concerned should we be about the solvency of the FDIC? This agency is in charge of protecting $4.5 trillion in bank deposits. It's got $10 billion on its books. Disconcerting?
The FDIC is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, and it has the ability to borrow from the U.S. Treasury up to $500 billion if it needs to. But having said that, let me just add that the FDIC has, I think, about $10 billion in the fund at the moment after reserves. They've taken $32 billion of reserves for losses that have not occurred. If you put that $32 billion back in, then there's really $42 billion in the fund. But to put the 400 problem banks in perspective, at the end of 1991, we had 1,500 banks on the problem list. So I think the short answer is nobody should be concerned about the FDIC.
Oh, remind us how the FDIC is funded. It is not the taxpayers.
No, it's funded completely by the banks. The banks pay premiums every year or assessments every year. When the fund dips down, the banks are obliged to fill it back up again.
Sheila Bair did say today that she doesn't anticipate needing to borrow from the government. So, of course, that means potentially higher charges to the banks. Presumably, that will be passed on to customers?
Presumably, bank charges will be passed along to customers. But I would say that I am concerned that we not raise these assessments on banks right now. The FDIC will probably do it, but I wish they wouldn't.
Why not?
Because it's counter-cyclical. It doesn't help the economic recovery. We need for banks to be loaning money right now, and banks can loan approximately $10 for every dollar of capital they have. So when the FDIC takes a dollar of capital away from the banks to put into the fund, that's $10 of lending the banks can't do. And I think the time to build the FDIC fund is after the banking system has been stabilized and after the economy's been stabilized and starting to grow again.
But what about for the immediate future? If you have more banks, what, there are 415 or so on the list as troubled. If a bunch of those go belly up and the FDIC doesn't have the money, are you saying that the taxpayer would be a better source than the banks themselves?
Sure. The Treasury would loan the FDIC money if it needed to borrow money, and then it would be repaid after the economy is recovered and the banking system is recovered. That money would be paid back, including interest on it. So it doesn't cost the taxpayers anything at all. They're just loaning the money to the FDIC to get through this period.
Bill Isaac is the chairman of LECG Global Financial Services. He was chairman of the FDIC from 1981 to 1986. Thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Wall Street overcame early losses today. We'll have details when we do the numbers. You got to wonder what's going on when companies that have been bailed out by the federal government are some of the hottest stocks around. In the last few weeks, AIG, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac all have bounced big time. Of course, we the taxpayers are big investors in all three. Marketplace's Amy Scott looked into when we might get to cash out.
There are a few reasons investors might be buying Fannie, Freddie, and AIG. The housing market has stabilized somewhat. AIG recently reported better-than-expected profits. But here's a reason not to buy. In all three cases, the federal government is a senior preferred shareholder. So if you're a common stockholder, you have to wait in line for a share of any profits.
You would be looking at a very long time before you actually got any return on your money, because the government must be paid back first.
That's Rod Smith with Riverfront Investment Group. He says investors may be thinking they have a better chance of making money.
If the stocks were priced that there was almost no chance, and now there's a little bit of a chance, then the stock should be higher.
Just for some perspective, AIG traded at nearly $1,500 a share a few years ago. Now it's around $50. Tom Mitchell follows financial stocks at Miller Tabak. He says eventually a higher stock price would help AIG raise capital, and that would help the company pay taxpayers back. But he says it's not there yet.
AIG's stock price has to go up by 10 or 20 times to really make a difference. That's in our opinion. It needs to go up a lot more before the potential for raising new capital becomes significant enough that it would really affect, you know, the government's position or its options.
Mitchell says a lot of the people buying AIG or Fannie Mae don't necessarily believe in their long-term future. They're speculators cashing in on short-term swings in prices. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Competition among big drugstore chains has gotten so fierce that no market is off limits. Beach chairs and boxes of macaroni and cheese now compete with eye exams and blood pressure machines. One regional pharmacy chain is looking to add services for a group that typically doesn't get much marketing attention, the terminally ill. Joel Rose reports.
By the time patients need hospice care, the usual array of tablets and pills may be difficult for them to swallow. That's when special solutions and medications come into play. The problem is they often aren't available at retail drugstores, but you can now find them at 15 Jewel Osco pharmacies in the Chicago area. Matt Cross is the company's regional manager.
A lot of these hospices are challenged by finding the medications that they need, and time is of the essence. We keep this in stock, and that way it allows them to just ultimately take better care of their patients.
I could probably tell you 25 medications. If you could just keep these 25 in stock all the time, I would be delirious with joy.
Lynn McPherson is an expert on end-of-life care at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. She says Jewel Osco is filling a real need among those who care for the terminally ill.
You can continue to give them their pain medication, drugs for nausea, for anxiety, for delirium, right up to the end. And if we don't have those, we're up the creek.
If the program is a success, Jewel Osco says it will consider expanding it. Adam Fine is the president of Pembroke Consulting. He says retail pharmacies need to find a competitive edge if they want to survive against giants like Walmart.
The smaller, regionally focused chains are looking for a way to distinguish their business from the business of the very large companies.
Fine says pharmacies are looking to play a greater role in their patients' lives, in this case, right up to the end. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve Board is trying to head off a court order to reveal which banks accepted emergency loans. Earlier this week, a U.S. district judge granted a Freedom of Information Act request by Bloomberg News. John Dimsdale reports the Fed and the banks think disclosure is a bad idea.
Banks say that going public would undermine their credibility, scaring away customers and investors and causing more bank failures. The Fed also supports keeping the list of banks secret. Villanova Business School professor Victor Lee suspects it's a question of timing.
we're at the point where the economy is beginning to show signs of stabilization, and perhaps the Fed doesn't want to introduce additional elements of instability or at least unpredictability.
If the courts back off, Congress might require disclosure anyway. The Senate has approved an amendment that would force the Fed to reveal the banks. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders sponsored the provision.
It is simply insane that you have an institution, the Fed, that is lending out trillions of taxpayer dollars at zero interest rates, and then when asked, they refuse to tell us who has received this money.
So far, U.S. District Court Judge Loretta Preska is standing by her August 31st deadline for a list of banks that took emergency loans and the amounts they borrowed. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
It's a safe bet more than a few of you will be feasting on a wedding buffet this weekend. Tis the season for newlywed bliss. There'll be some small talk with strangers. Oh, are you with the groom's side or the bride's? But if you happen to run into commentator Betsy Stevenson, she's got a different conversation going on in her head, which she shares in today's edition of Econ Fun 01, our look at what the pointy heads do for fun.
Most people think that if you let an economist into your personal life, they'll tell you how to rebalance your portfolio. While that might be true, economists see markets at play everywhere, even in your romantic life. Indeed, I'm one of the worst guests that you can invite to your wedding. Why? Because while most of your guests are listening for your love story, I'm listening for your contract. While others see a romantic courtship leading to the altar, I see people who are satisfied enough to stop searching for someone else. Economists simply can't believe in one soulmate. There are too many people in the world, and the odds of finding that one person in 5 billion are, well, you can do the math. So if economists don't believe in soulmates, why do we think people get married? Well, searching for a spouse is very similar to searching for a job. There's not one perfect job for each of us, but there are clearly better and worse jobs. So we hunt for a spouse and a job. When do we stop? When the offer in the hand is better than the likely offer in the bush. So at a wedding, I see a relationship that's good enough to settle down and start investing in. If you get a reasonable rate of return, investment in your relationship will make it truly better than any other relationship you could have. And that's why I listen to people's vows, to understand what they want out of their marriage, or, in economist speak, what they're contracting over. How important are fidelity, loyalty, generosity, kindness? As an economist, I think that a good marriage, like a good employment relationship, has shared vision, common interests, complementary abilities, and gains from specialization. So, if you want to hold on to a romantic illusion, don't invite me to your ceremony. But if you do, please don't sit me next to your cousin in banking. We likely have less in common than you think.
Betsy Stevenson teaches economics at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Your thoughts? Share them with us at marketplace.org. Coming up, Native American businesses branch out.
Tribes have to be aware that gaming's not going to last forever, and it's going to be subject to some of the same impacts that affect economies every day.
But first, let's do the numbers. The markets edged up just a little bit again today, enough to make it 8 in a row for the Dow, its longest winning streak in more than 2 years. The industrial average scooped up 37 points, a tad more than one-third of 1% to end at 95.80. The NASDAQ gained 3 points, one-tenth of 1% to finish at 20.27. The S&P 500 added 2 points, one-quarter of 1% to close at 10.30. Boeing ascended more than 8%. The company said its long-awaited new Dreamliner would lift off by the end of the year, finally. And as we alluded to earlier, American International Group soared nearly 27% today after the new chief executive said he's not keen on the idea of a fire sale for any of the insurer's assets. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone. From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for July. Missouri joins 22 other states to outlaw texting while driving, but this law targets youngsters. Those 21 and under face a $200 fine if caught reading, writing, or sending electronic messages behind the wheel. And on August 28, 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his famous speech beginning, "I Have a Dream." I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. You may have heard anecdotally that lots of folks who've lost their jobs turn to volunteering. That's what we do in a pinch, right? We all pull together. Well, someone decided to put some numbers on that question, and it turns out Americans are actually donating less of their time in this recession. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Today's report comes from the National Conference on Citizenship, a nonprofit organization set up by Congress that measures the nation's civic health. Executive Director David Smith says the latest checkup shows
the economic recession is causing a civic depression.
He says 72% of Americans are cutting back on time spent volunteering. Traditionally, during a slight economic downturn, Smith says people increase their civic engagement. But that changes when a recession is more severe.
When it reaches a certain threshold and we see unemployment rise significantly, around 9 to 10%, people actually move from engaging in their communities to pulling back.
Smith says Americans are still generous, but refocusing their efforts at a local level.
Reaching out, providing food, money, and shelter to those that are in need, but much more intimate forms and informal forms of engagement.
That shift away from traditional forms of volunteering is particularly bad news for nonprofits. Charitable donations are way down and aren't expected to rebound for several years. Sandra Minuti is with Charity Navigator, which tracks the financial health of nonprofits.
Every day we get reports of nonprofits having to lay off staff. If people are cutting back on their volunteer efforts, charities may find themselves in a deeper hole.
She says charities had hoped that highly skilled, unemployed folks might lend specific expertise that goes beyond the normal stuffing of envelopes. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The spirit of volunteerism may have waned along with the economy, but a new book argues that a renewed sense of community is the one bright spot that tends to emerge out of calamity. This weekend marks the fourth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, and that disaster is one of five explored in Rebecca Solnit's book, A Paradise Built in Hell. We all, of course, remember the death and destruction that befell cities all along the Gulf Coast, perhaps most tragically, the submersion of New Orleans. But Solnit remembers something else, something that follows a pattern of previous disasters going as far back as the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So here we are approaching the fourth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. You did quite a bit of reporting out of New Orleans shortly after the storm. Can you describe what you saw?
You know, I saw a lot of remarkable stuff that didn't make it into the mainstream news. I saw heroic efforts to rebuild on the part of the people there themselves, but also hundreds of thousands of volunteers. It was as though the Freedom Summer of the Civil Rights Movement had been expanded a thousandfold. Hmm. People rise to the occasion and often do so with joy because, in a certain sense, it's everyday life that's a disaster for most of us, a disaster of isolation and alienation and purposelessness that people often overcome in taking care of each other and responding in the urgent tasks at hand. So that's the broad response. You have a minority of people, often people in power, who assume that the rest of us are monsters, and they tend to panic because they think that the monsters have been unleashed. And you certainly saw that with the media and some other government officials in Katrina.
And what do you mean by that?
FEMA and other people decided that since the New Orleanians were so dangerous, they were more focused on safety and in treating these people as criminals than on rescuing them. FEMA and other federal authorities were even preventing others from rescuing and water and supplies from coming in. And so it's part of the madness of Katrina is that everybody was obsessed with these crimes that weren't happening, the supposed mass rapes and murders in the Superdome and Convention Center, and didn't see these other crimes that were in fact happening and that still aren't really recognized enough.
In the book, you talk about what these kinds of disasters do to upend class structure. All of a sudden, everybody in the community is without a home, without access to bank accounts. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It doesn't unfold the same way in every disaster, but often there is this kind of meltdown of all the structures that divide and sort us out, and people are literally or figuratively in the same boat. Doctors and patients are now on the same level, waiting to be evacuated from a hospital or trying to get out of a hospital. Tourists were in New Orleans were stranded with locals. All kinds of people were brought together, and that often comes as a kind of liberation from the ways that people are ordinarily divided.
You know, we've just been through a different kind of disaster over the last year or so, a financial one. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who was untouched by it. I wonder what you think about our reaction to the economic crisis compared to the way the people of New Orleans reacted to Katrina.
I think that in the kind of disasters I write about, the sudden disasters of an earthquake, an explosion, a hurricane, you know, you wake up and everything's different. It's wide open who you are and what you're going to do about it. An economic disaster is different for the most part in that it's so selective. Some of us are now unemployed. Some of us are now evicted from our foreclosed upon homes. Some of us aren't. And so it doesn't create quite the same broad inclusive community within a region. But I do see people improvising responses that have the same kind of resourcefulness and solidarity. And I do see the same willingness to question the status quo, to rethink what is capitalism, what is this economy, what are these gigantic bonuses, what is this corrosive mortgage system, what else could it be? That has the same kind of opening you often see in these more immediate disasters.
Rebecca Solnit's new book is called A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Foxwoods Casino was long one of the biggest in the Northeast U.S., but the Connecticut resort has been down on its luck in recent years. Yesterday, the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation decided to restructure its debt because it took a card on 17. The National Indian Gaming Association says tribes that own casinos ring up $26 billion in gross profits each year, but a growing number are not betting on the blackjack tables or slot machines to fill their coffers indefinitely. Brian Bull reports from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Lucky Eagle Casino is a 90-minute drive south of Seattle. It's run by the Chehalis tribe, and tribal chairman David Burnett says gambling's been good to his people. It rings up nearly $15 million annually for health care, education, and roads.
As recently as 1999, the tribe was functionally bankrupt. We're in a much better position today than we have been in a long, long time.
But the Chehalis didn't want to bank on gambling forever. Last year, they decided to diversify their portfolio with what you could say were more liquid assets. 5 minutes drive away at the Great Wolf Resort, tourists ride rolling waves at a sprawling water park. The resort cost $100 million to build. Burnett recalls the grand opening of the water park last spring.
I got to be one of the first to go down the big water slide. And it was a little bit humbling when I had some 16-year-old in a lifeguard suit tell me that if I didn't quit horsing around, he would kick me out of the park.
Burnett says some tribal members were skeptical, but over the last year, the resort has kept afloat just fine. Other Native American tribes across the country have started similar ventures that don't bank on gambling. There are tribes running shopping malls, chocolate factories, and golf courses as well. Joe Kalt co-directs the Harvard Project on American Indian Economic Development. He says this trend has sprung, in part, from casinos.
Gaming operations have turned out to be fairly good training grounds. So you're starting to develop a lot of managerial talent out there. And, of course, it manifests itself as a little bit of entrepreneurship.
Kalt says casino revenue started to flatten out even before the recession, in part because more and more casinos sprung up around the country. That's why tribes like the Forest County Potawatomi of Wisconsin started looking for new ventures. The tribe launched a business development corporation in 2003. Based in Milwaukee's historic district, its plush offices sport frosted windows and leather seats. Pepe Randolph is its VP for sales and marketing.
Tribes have to be aware that gaming is not going to last forever, and it's going to be subject to some of the same impacts that affect economies every day. What we hope to be able to do is to be able to make wise investments, to build our portfolio, to grow our base, so that we're going to one day be able to be that strong sibling to gaming for our tribe.
Randolph says they have 15 different companies nationwide. The Potawatomi say they make cautious, low-risk investments. And while not the sexiest portfolio, Randolph credits their investment strategy for a 42% growth in revenue last year.
Sky's the limit for us. We continue to expand.
That's James Crawford, a former chairman of the Development Corporation. He says tribal enterprises aren't just expanding beyond the reservation, but across the globe. Right now, one of their design firms may score a deal constructing streets and buildings in India.
I remember getting off the plane in Mumbai when we got there, and I was like, who would ever thought this small-town Potawatomi boy would be standing in the streets of Mumbai looking to do business?
Who would have bet on that? In Wisconsin, I'm Brian Bull for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, good news for sufferers of the pre-recorded commercial telemarketing call, also known as the robocall. Today, the Federal Trade Commission banned them as of September 1st. Unless, of course, you give telemarketers written permission to call you. Yeah, we'll get right on that. Violations will cost marketers up to $16,000 per call. There are, however, exceptions to the ban. So don't be surprised if Mr. Robo still calls you from a political campaign, banks, telephone carriers, and most charities. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 37 points, about a third of a percent. The NASDAQ rose 3 points, a tenth of a percent. And the S&P added 2 points, a quarter of a percent. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the program, selling anything, and I mean anything, on the radio.
So we've got some cowboys that will go down to the water and maybe wrestle a 3-foot alligator, and they'll try to sell an alligator on the swap shop.
I'm Des Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.